This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you highlights from 2015. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. As 2015 came to a close, fear and safety concerns weighed heavily on the minds of Americans. Mass shootings in the United States have become almost a monthly occurrence. On December 2nd, 14 dead and 21 wounded in San Bernardino, California, in a shooting that was characterized later as a terrorist attack. On November 29th, 3 dead and 9 injured in Colorado Springs, Colorado. October 1st, 9 dead and 9 injured in Roseburg, Oregon. On July 16th, 5 dead and 3 wounded in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And on June 8th, 9 dead in South Carolina, and on and on. President Obama said that prayers alone would not solve the gun violence problem in America, and he addressed the nation on December 6th, saying, quote, "We need to make it harder for people to buy powerful assault weapons like the ones that were used in San Bernardino," unquote. Jim Kessler, Senior Vice President for Policy at Third Way, was our guest on Encounter at the beginning of December and had this to say regarding the intersection of terrorism and easy access to guns in America.
I do think the inevitable just happened in San Bernardino. And yes, it happened in Fort Hood as well. But there is very, very easy availability of firearms in this country. It's always been a problem for, you know, just your run-of-the-mill crime and even your run-of-the-mill mass shooter. It was only a matter of time until terrorist elements in this country started taking advantage of those weak gun laws. And I think we're going to see more of these in the future. So I do think there needs to be heightened efforts overseas through Homeland Security, but gun laws have to be addressed as well.
However, because the deadly attack in San Bernardino involved two shooters, a husband and a wife, who had been radicalized and had links to Islamist extremists, our second guest on Encounter, Stephen Bucci of the Heritage Foundation, saw the problem differently. He discounted the call for stricter gun regulations, and he characterized President Obama's strategy to defeat ISIS as insufficient.
For us, ISIS is the problem right now. They're the threat to not just the region, but to the whole world. And now, as we see after San Bernardino, at least in an indirect way, to the United States proper. You know, we can look at guns, we can look at pipe bombs, we can look at knives, but it all comes down to the radical Islamist ideology that ISIS chases. It's not common to the rest of the Muslim world. It's very much a fringe ideology. That ideology must be crushed. And until we remove the draw for recruitment of ISIS in presently Iraq and Syria, they're going to continue to recruit people at an alarming rate. And right now, the president's strategy is not sufficient to remove that.
Many of the terrorists, or jihadists as they call themselves, are being radicalized via social media. They communicate via encrypted messages, and ISIS has become quite sophisticated in its recruitment techniques. On the day of the shootings in San Bernardino, the female shooter, Tashfin Malik, had pledged allegiance to the leader of ISIS on Facebook using an account registered to a pseudonym. But fighting ISIS has become a global problem, and it seems that these days no country is immune from terrorism. After the Charlie Hebdo murders, which took place in January 2015, France had beefed up its security by deploying 10,000 soldiers across the country. And yet, this move did not prevent the deadly attacks by homegrown Islamist terrorists on November 13th in Paris. Benjamin Haddad, a research fellow at the Hudson Institute, and Jessica Ashu of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council explained the implications of these attacks for European security. Benjamin Haddad.
Clearly, it shows that French and I would say European intelligence agencies and security forces are overwhelmed by the challenge. This threat has considerably accelerated over the last 3 years, especially with the drawn of the Syrian civil war and the rise of ISIS. In the region, the French have been fighting terrorism for a long time, and they're known for the quality of their intelligence services. But Manuel Valls, the prime minister, just announced the third law against terrorism for the last 3 years. This challenge terms of the number of fighters that are going to Syria, that are coming back, is extremely daunting for French intelligence services. They've been announcing recruits over the last few years, but you need to train these people. You need to give them the cultural expertise, the human intelligence to be able to infiltrate the network. So it's a complicated challenge. And obviously, there's no zero risk. You know, that is something that European societies will have to understand, accept, integrate, and be resilient against. There's no zero risk. There are lots of attacks that were foiled before that one, as you know, like the high-speed train Paris-Amsterdam last summer, an attack that was foiled by the bravery of American soldiers. Beyond the French dimension, there's a European dimension. These attacks were planned in Syria, but they were organized in Belgium. This is where the terrorists, most of them French citizens, got their weapons, rented their cars, communicated, and the Belgian authorities are totally overwhelmed by this challenge. This is the country, by the way, in terms of proportion, that is sending the most radicals in Syria. And the free circulation zone, you know, the open borders of the Schengen area, only reinforce this necessity to increase cooperation between European security forces. This is one of the things that the French authorities have been asking for over the last few days. But it shows that this challenge is clearly overwhelming for European authorities.
And how and where do ISIS members operate? Jessica Ashu speaks to this aspect of the attacks.
I'd like to move to the situation on the ground in Syria, because I think that we can't discuss the terror threat emanating from ISIS without talking about what's happening on the ground in Syria. And once again, unfortunately, this episode really shows the danger of ungoverned spaces in the Middle East. It's something that we saw in the aftermath of 9/11, and it's something that we're seeing again now. And the interesting thing is that you can see how a group like ISIS takes advantage of the space that they control. And if you compare the tactics that ISIS tends to use versus the tactics of, for example, Al-Qaeda, you can see very clearly how they're using the space in Syria. They have free rein to operate in more than half of Syria, and they have free rein to train in urban assault settings. And that's why you see ISIS favoring these types of attacks that happen in cities. They happen with light weapons. They know how to really inflict terror on a population. Now, that's as opposed to Al-Qaeda, which had to operate much more in the shadows. It was a much harder organization to join. They were not as prolific with allowing people into their organization. They were much more cautious. And as a result, you saw much more elaborate plots that were carried out over years, but were spectacular. So you see really two different groups that are both very dangerous using ungoverned spaces to their advantage. And it underscores really the point that if you want to protect against these types of attacks in the future, you must shut down their battle and training spaces.
And contrary to initial press reports, all identified terrorists involved in the Paris attacks were European nationals. The vast majority of the refugees fleeing Syria have no links to terrorism and are literally running for their lives, trying to escape the brutality of the Bashar al-Assad regime, which is propped up by Tehran and Moscow, or from ISIS. Still yet, many populist right-wing politicians in both Europe and the United States question the wisdom of taking in refugees fleeing Syria after the Paris attacks. However, Germany has stood out as the most welcoming host country. Time magazine, which named German Chancellor Angela Merkel its Person of the Year, cited her role in Europe's crisis over migration. For weeks, the European Union was trying to decide how to best handle the exodus of thousands and thousands of people. In September, we asked Rafik Joujati, director of Free Syria and spokeswoman for the local coordinating committees in Syria, and Dimitrios Papadimitriou, president emeritus of the Migration Policy Institute, to what extent inaction on the part of the West in solving the Syrian conflict contributed to driving many of these refugees out of their homes. Dimitrios Papadimitriou.
I think there is enough blame to go around. So instead of focusing on the blame, let's try to focus on the one or two failures that in many ways are contributing to the chaotic situation in Europe at this time. I think if we go beyond the politics and the failures in Syria and other parts of the Middle East, Iraq and what have you, is the fact that we did not pay enough attention to the people who have left Syria and overwhelmingly had gone to three countries, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. These people have been there sometimes for 2, 3, or 4 years, and they have basically been warehoused in camps. Many of them live outside of the camps. The international response to the needs of these people has been inadequate and very regretfully so poor. And after a while, people understood that there was no way that they could resume their lives. They could have anything but just the basics if they stayed there. So if you combine the failure to create opportunities for people to resume their lives here, offer education to their children, being able to train people to create a sense that they can stick around there a little bit longer to see the possibility of something positive happening in Syria, by now they've lost hope.
Analysts say they've lost hope in part because the world seemed to have given up on addressing the root causes of the Syrian conflict, Syrian civilians, and those who rose up peacefully to protest the regime of Bashar al-Assad in 2011 felt abandoned as President Assad literally got away with murdering his own people and giving rise to the so-called Islamic State. Rafif Joyjati shared with us the drama of many Syrian refugees who decided to flee their country and underscored the root causes of the migrant crisis in Europe.
Since we're talking about the root causes, I think we need to go even before the refugee situation in Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan. We need to look at the root causes of why there are Syrian refugees, period. Knowing now that there are at least 12 million internally displaced or refugee people, this constitutes more than half the population of Syria. And I think we need to point the finger very squarely at the regime of Bashar al-Assad. We need to go back to March of 2011 when students went out in peaceful protest and the regime's response was a military assault on a civilian population. As the revolution continued on and as the military assault grew more fierce, we saw people fleeing. They were fleeing barrel bombs. They were fleeing snipers. They were fleeing cities under siege, shelling. Starvation campaigns by the Assad regime. And so they were looking for places to survive. They weren't trying to take other people's jobs or have better opportunities in the Great West. They were fleeing for their lives. And I think we cannot forget that, even as we're seeing these thousands and thousands of people trying to get across Europe.
Meanwhile, in the United States, the 2016 presidential campaign got underway in full swing. GOP presidential contender and frontrunner Donald Trump had been capturing headlines for months. Analysts say he appeals primarily to lower middle-class white voters without college degrees. They say he has managed to alienate other important constituencies with his remarks about banning Muslims from coming to the United States in the aftermath of the San Bernardino terror attacks. Notwithstanding earlier disparaging remarks about Hispanics and women, Trump still leads polls among Republican primary voters. Here is Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of the Rothenberg and Gonzalez Political Report, who was our encounter guest back in August, explaining what's behind the so-called Trump factor.
Well, I think it's clear that Donald Trump has tapped into a segment of the Republican electorate that likes his style. They like it brash, in their mind, a tell-it-like-it-is style, and that is appealing to about 20% of the primary electorate. And I think those people are valuing that style above all else. They're willing to look past personal issues or look past issue positions that he has held, contrary to the Republican Party. And so that's what he is tapping into.
Igor Volsky, contributing editor of thinkprogress.org, a progressive political blog affiliated with the Center for American Progress, was our second guest on the show. He attributed the so-called Trump phenomenon to the fact that some Republican voters are fed up with traditional politicians and the status quo in Washington.
Yeah, he surprised a lot of people, and his numbers continue to shock political pundits, certainly, and even some Republican voters. But the numbers are mostly meaningless. You look at polls 4 years ago, and Newt Gingrich was leading in Iowa then. Certainly, that meant very little. He didn't win Iowa. He came in, you know, at the bottom of the pack in Iowa. And so this early on, it has actually very little meaning for who can be the nominee, who can be president. And so I think, yes, the key here is that he's tapped into this discontent that people have with Washington, with politics as usual. And if you look at the other side of the aisle, Bernie Sanders, while the two men have very little in common, Sanders certainly has an appeal of being the anti-politician, of saying things simply, clearly, and as he sees them without this kind of political maneuvering that a lot of Americans on both sides of the aisle, I think, are really fed up with.
The U.S. Congress has been polarized for years, and even though Republicans now hold the majority in both the House and the Senate, the highest U.S. legislative body is still quite divided. Frustrated with the stalemate, Republican John Boehner surprised even his own colleagues when, in late September, he announced his resignation from the speakership of the House of Representatives. John Fortier, director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Well, it wasn't a surprise, I think, to most in Washington, but the factors underlying it are not new. They've been there, really, for the last several years of his speakership. The Republican caucus is fractious, to say the least. It has a part of it, which is 50 or so members, who are much more combative, more conservative a bit, but really it's a very conservative caucus generally, but more tactically willing to challenge the president, not wanting the Speaker of the House to compromise. And we've seen this again and again when we get to the end of the year or a time where we need to pass our appropriations bills. There's a time of a real decision that this group is often reluctant to deal with the president or want to go along with the deal that the leaders of the Republican Party have cut. So we were facing this again. We were looking at a deal that was going to have to be cut to keep the government going. The Speaker, I think, rightly recognized that he was going to be in the crosshairs of another fight like this and has said he did not want to be a distraction, wanted to get out of the way, but that the Speaker will serve his time, get this deal done, and move on and be replaced by another who will likely face some of the same challenges with the caucus, which is, again, hard to corral as a majority.
After several candidates threw their hats into the ring, in late October, the Republican-dominated Congress chose Representative Paul Ryan to succeed John Boehner, averting the threat of a fiscal crisis that has been a Washington hallmark in recent years. But after much wrangling in mid-December, members of Congress reached consensus on a year-end spending deal for fiscal 2016. The bill's most contentious provision would end a four-decade ban on oil exports, a major energy policy shift long sought by Republicans and welcomed even by the White House. Pope Francis's visit to the nation's capital back in September captivated people of all faiths and backgrounds and constituted a rare moment of bipartisan unity. Republicans and Democrats alike enthusiastically welcomed the pontiff. In his address to a joint session of Congress, Pope Francis tackled two issues dear to his heart, immigration and climate change. Our encounter guest, Anthony Arendt, professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University, shared with us his impressions of the Pope's historic visit to the United States.
Well, I think it has truly been remarkable. And I think much of it has been remarkable because of his approach. The Pope is a very humble person, and he emphasizes helping others, serving the poor, reaching out to the most disenfranchised people among us, helping the immigrants, acknowledging himself that he is an immigrant, and that we all have to be open, that we have to take very seriously climate change, and emphasizing the fact that climate change is real and it must be addressed now, else future generations will suffer dire consequences. I think so much of the Pope's approach is him. He's not saying anything that hasn't been said before, but rather than coming out as doctrinal and lambasting individuals for various things, he's coming out as a man who emphasizes love. He's coming out and speaking in the spirit of the gospel. It's not a new message. It's a 2,000-year-old message. And yet the way he is conveying it, I have to think, was the way it was conveyed 2,000 years ago. And this is resonating with the people. It's resonating with Catholics. It's resonating with non-Catholics. I thought it was extraordinarily significant that at his homily at St. Patrick's Cathedral, he began by praying for the Muslims who were trampled to death at the Hajj, emphasizing the brotherhood of people of all faiths.
Marianne Cusimano Love, Associate Professor of International Relations at the Catholic University of America, the second encounter panelist on that same program, agreed with Professor Arendt that Pope Francis is indeed a consequential pontiff.
I think what we see with Pope Francis is that he speaks the language of action, and actions speak louder than words. And people respond to that. His message resonates because they can see he's walking the walk, not just talking cheap talk. And I think we also see, I would agree with Anthony, that people around the world, not just Catholics, are responding to his message, because I think we see wisdom doesn't get old, as the movie slogan is saying these days, and that people are recognizing in him ancient wisdom about the need to put people first, to put the least among us first, and to recognize our common humanity, our common human family, and our need to work together. He's been consistent in his discussion of what I call the four P's: people, poverty, the planet, and peace.
And of course, reducing the impact of climate change has been a high priority for U.S. President Barack Obama, especially during his second and final term, which is coming to a close. While in the United States, Pope Francis reiterated the importance of combating global warming, a subject on which he has written an encyclical. But does his message resonate with Republicans in the House of Representatives? Here again is Professor Anthony Arendt.
You know, it's a very difficult issue. My sense is that the science is extraordinarily clear. Pope Francis understands that the science is extraordinarily clear. And at the White House ceremony the other day, he commended President Obama on moves to do something about climate change. But it almost seems as though for some individuals, it is a matter of, if I can use the word faith, as opposed to science. There seem to be some individuals, you can present the scientific data, you can bring in the very best scientific minds in the world. They can show you the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. They can show you the depletion of the glaciers. They can show you the inundation of islands that are taking place. And people simply don't believe, almost as a matter of faith. I'm not sure some individuals can be convinced. However, we don't need to convince every individual, we just need to convince a large majority of individuals who can take some kind of action. And I think if anyone would be on the fence, what the Pope is saying may add an extra level of credibility to the people that say climate change is real. The one problem is it's very easy for a politician to dismiss the Pope in talking about climate change simply by saying, well, he doesn't have a PhD in science, even though he did actually train in science.
Yes, indeed, he's a chemist by training.
Exactly. But people that are in that category, people for whom this becomes some kind of strange tenet of faith, his statements may not convince them. However, there are a lot of other people that may be convinced. And as I said, you don't need to convince everybody. You just need to convince an overwhelming majority to move and get action.
Not coincidentally, barely 2 weeks ago, the 2015 UN Climate Change Conference, also known as COP21, was held in Paris with the participation of 196 parties. According to the Paris Agreement, governments reaffirmed their commitment to keep the average global temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrialized levels and to pursue efforts to keep this to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So, despite many challenges facing the planet, it seems that there are some points of convergence. Just prior to the COP21 talks, Paris, the host city, and legendary City of Light had witnessed the deadliest terror attacks since World War II. And even though French President François Hollande said France was at war with terrorism, he warned against overreactions and said that no xenophobic, anti-Semitic, or anti-Muslim acts would be tolerated. He also reaffirmed his promise that France would take in about 30,000 refugees over the next 2 years, demonstrating both resilience and magnanimity in the face of tragedy. And on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this special year-end edition of Encounter. Before we go, this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And you can always send feedback via email to encounter@voanews.com. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you all a very healthy and happy new year. Thanks to Anna Zalewski, Rick Pantaleo, and Evan Anichka for producing this year-end edition of the program. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week and next year for another encounter on The Voice of America.